fill out the content. Okay, one thing that I, from last night's conversation, was a pretty robust, I thought, conversation. One thing I thought I wanted to say tonight and today that...
I had a chair.
I don't know how close I want to sit to the door, though, all of a sudden.
It's really cold.
From there.
Low temperatures.
So only women care about the building.
That
can't be true. I said only women care about development because only women are in the city. Unless you don't know that this is we're talking about human development.
Yes, I do know. That's why I'm here.
Perfect.
I missed yesterday your first session. But if you could just kind of summarize it for me, that would be great.
Sure. Let me.
You have mosquito right on your chin, right?
Probably.
There.
Wait.
Okay. Wait a couple minutes.
Oh, I don't know.
Start at 10:10.
I think we should go ahead and start.
I'll start. I'll just briefly share with you what I'm trying to do this week. I don't know if I've been doing it. What I'm trying to do is hold up this notion of generative, in stage theory, in stages of human development. The last stage, at least in the model that I'm using, is called generative. And this comes from Eric Erickson's work, who's a psychologist, and other people have different names for it, but in general, they always describe this last stage of human development in similar ways. And when I get people together, I try to get them to share with me what do you like at your best. And typically, the verbs and nouns that come out map pretty clearly, closely to what the theorists say people are like at their generative best. So they tend to be like creative. What are you like at your best? I know some of us have already done this, but what are you like at your best? Or in other people that you think of as particularly mature and gifted and on the leading edge, what are they like? What do they contribute to the world that you admire? Any thoughts?
Vision and...
Vision?
Seem to see the bigger picture and set their ego aside a little bit to accomplish things for the greater good and...
Insightful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's it. I have a friend who's remarkably insightful. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to people about her, and after a few years, somebody said, "Well, what did Sally say?" Because I liked her. She was very insightful. I thought that she could, as you say, go in a little different direction. Mm-hmm.
I like the notion of insight. I also think in some ways that the wisdom, right, mm-hmm. captures the difference between knowledge that you might have at 20.
Exactly.
You can be really smart, I think, at 20. I'm not sure you can be wise until you have developed the capacities of generative living. So wisdom is another sort of feature of or insight. And it seems to be a kind of practical knowledge that is right for the situation. So discernment.
Discernment
gets used.
Which seems to say spirituality, in
right.
a sense.
So these are some of the features we could say of generative. And then the way I'm, among other things, I do coaching, so executive coaching, which is kind of secularized spiritual direction. It's the way I sneak in, try to change, in some ways, the culture of the large institutions or organizations in which people live. So I do executive coaching, and so I invite people to think about how is it that they can be more generative in their life, and then why are the reasons we're not? I mean, we are all grown-ups, but we are not all generative all the time.
Crisis.
At least I speak for myself. I'm not generative all the time. Why is that? And then, I put that notion of generativity as a sort of overarching theme, and then look at the stages of development. And then suggest that adult human beings, get triggered back to earlier stages so that even the most generative person contains all the stages of development within them. That we pass through them, we don't get rid of them, the stages. They are part of who we are. And so then what we did a bit the first day and then yesterday, was go over some of these other stages. And I use a 5-stage model. What I'm trying to emphasize today, to start out. We got waylaid a little bit last night because the stages are tied into ages. And then I think people resisted thinking about children in these terms. But I really, I use this to think about our own adulthood reverting to a more childish way. So they become negative only when you're a child, when you're an adult behaving as a, when you're 40 something, behaving as an 18-year-old, that's a problem. When you're an 18-year-old behaving as an 18-year-old, that's totally appropriate. But I think because some of the language I'll show you is a little bit negative, people were a little resistant to describing their own children in quite that way. So I have five stages.
Why? My fault in my children. I should have
known. So the first stage that, and this is, you know, this is based on a collection of theorists, as I mentioned. Lawrence Kohlberg does moral development, and he has six stages, and proposes maybe a seventh stage for those, you know, super moral thinkers like Gandhi and so forth. Jean Piaget is the cognitive developmentalist. Eric Erickson had eight stages. He's a psychological development. There's some people look at emotional development, and Jim Fowler is a Methodist, and he looked at faith development. Wrote a book in the 80s called Stages of Faith, which is pretty well known. And I draw on all of these and try to put together a kind of holistic notion of human development, where I actually see spiritual development, emotional development, cognitive development, all of them on a piece. Right? So, again, I apologize for those who came the first night to go over everything.
We're really getting this now.
Okay. The first one I call enforcer. And it's 0 to 3, and the reason I call it enforcer is because the way they get their needs met is they enforce their will upon the world. So they scream and shout. And it's an enforcer because when an adult goes back to this stage, they use force. The way that you get your needs met, so I'm going to ask you about how they think. Thinking. Feeling. What are the needs? How they get their needs met, sorry. So this is how they deploy power, how they get their needs met. I was interested in what are the levels of commitment that each of these stages can have. And the sixth one that was added last night that I really thought was nice is what is the gospel at this stage? Or what is the promise? His last name is Coffee. Does anyone know his first name? He rode the bus, drove the bus.
Okay.
Oh, no. Anyway, sorry? Yeah. No. We had a Jack who drove the bus. Well, it's Coffee. Mr. Coffee, we'll call him. Yeah. He suggested we think about, and I really like this, what is the purpose or of the promise? And here he was referring to the gospel promise, or what is the religious solution to this particular? And I thought that was interesting to think that at each stage, we can think about that in a slightly different way. So, again, because we did this yesterday, I'll just quickly, it's episodic here. Thinking is, when you're 0 to 3, you're unable to, there's no sense of history yet. Everything is in the moment, right? So you cannot connect or concatenate things, right? It's just A. There's no A to B to C, right? At this early stage. And of course, 0 to 3, there's development within that age, right? But in general, we could say that thinking is episodic. Feelings are immediate and basic, right? So you do see some rage, some happiness, some glee. I mean, it is. I mean, I had a 3-year-old here, and she slept for 12 hours last night.
Oh, praise the Lord.
She's full of happiness. And there's something beautiful about it because it's, as I said, like it's unreflective. It just is, right? So you know when she's angry and you know when she's happy. You know when she's sad. So there probably are a broader range of emotions than those three, but those are the only three that I want to identify. So the feelings are pretty basic and pretty immediate. Okay. And the we'll look at these across, but in all, obviously in stages of development, what happens is we move from simple to complex, or more elaborate.
So one of the things that happens is as we become more sophisticated or we get older, we're able to have more emotions. We're able to name more emotions. Am I sad? No, I'm depressed. No, I'm chronically depressed, or I'm deeply depressed, or no, I'm just blue today. I mean, there's this whole range of words for a general, for a common feeling, because we're able to calibrate much more closely. But I think at this age, children are just unable to do that. They don't have the vocabulary. They can't even speak until they're roughly 2 years of age. So that's an important developmental milestone, is to be able to name things, because then you actually experience them a little bit differently. And part of the role of parenting or culture is to give people a vocabulary. But anyway, then we said the needs were survival and safety. Survival and safety. These are the basic needs at this stage. How do they get their needs met? Fight or flight, or scream or go away. And they also, again, if they want to experience joy, they'll play. So another way of getting their deploying power to get what they want. What do they do to get what they want? So they don't have a lot of options. Mm-hmm. But I do think play is another option. We got a little bit tricked up here last night. I won't do it again. I said they have zero, they have zero ability to commit. And a lot of people resisted that. Because I think in some way, we were operating different definitions of commitment. But a commitment is through time, that you are committed across time, that you pledge yourself to something in the future, right? So if I'm committed to this relationship for the full hour, right? I mean, a child at this stage can't even do that, because you have to know what an hour is before you can commit for an hour. So that doesn't mean that they can't love, that they can't have feelings of attachment, but it does mean that they can't think about a long-term relationship. But again, some of the mothers in the room were resistant to that. You know, the attachment theory suggests, no, they've been related to me before, you know, in my womb, so I didn't want to push it too much. But this sort of deep sense of moral commitment, let's at least say it's very low. And then the promise here, I would say that in every stage, the promise connects to the need. So what is the promise of the gospel to someone who is an enforcer? It is that the world is safe. Mm-hmm. And
was it God will care for you?
God will care for you.
Yeah.
Take care of your basic needs.
Take care of your basic needs. Yeah.
And really, Eric Erickson said that the most basic thing that children need at this stage is the sense that the world is trustworthy. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what word we could put in there. We put in several, but trustworthy. You said your needs are met.
If we're talking in a theological context, it's God, you know, God cares for you, God loves you. It's like the, you know, uber parent.
Right.
Security or providence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember the title of the book, but Anna Maria Rizzuto is a psychologist, and she talks about, does studies on children and how, I guess it's obvious, but their early understandings of God are directly tied to their understandings and their experience of parents. Okay, so that was the first one. And then I'll just take you through all the stages using these categories. And these ages are variable. They just give you a general schematic sense. So we're up to 3 and 2 more, which I'll add later, but they would be rebel producer and then generative.
What's the fourth?
Rebel producer.
Yeah.
So this would be college age kids or late high school college age. And this is where, I think if we go through each of these, it would be more helpful. And again, I'm going to go quickly on this one and spend a little more time on peacekeeper because we did it yesterday. So thinking and score, this is the age of my second child, so I have 1 in each stage. And the thinking here is concrete literal. It's going to be concrete literal in their thinking. Yeah. Now, again, I want to suggest that when people get stressed out, anxious, tired, they can resort back to this, and their actual thinking gets constricted. So, I mean, one of the terrible things, I don't know if you've had this, you have to write an exam, and you're feeling, if you feel anxious, actually, you can't deliver your best stuff because your actual ability to think is narrow. And we talked about this a little bit last night, I think it was you and I, that if a bear attacks, if you're walking down and you're having lofty thoughts, you've just read Augustine or whatever, and a bear comes out of the woods, right, and your safety and survival is at stake, your thinking goes immediately to episodic. Right now, what should I do? Boom. I don't care about what's for lunch. I don't care about my relationship to this bear. I don't care. You go to immediately. So it's, in some ways, it's appropriate to be regressed. But that's only if your survival and safety is really at stake. It's when we think, when we have this sort of resonance, it feels like that's what's up for us. That we can be tricked back to this and act out of this stage. Or our thinking could be constricted. So, feelings. When is that too? Does anyone have any suggestions on how a scorekeeper, a 4 to 10 year old, would feel? What are the dominant feelings that they have?
Well, we were talking last night about how they actually begin to notice feelings and they can begin to describe them, and they're getting some awareness.
Okay, so they're aware of their feelings. They can name them. So they're able to name.
They're also aware of others' feelings.
Oh, starting to be aware of others.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I really don't want to. That's
beginning.
Really the next stage that
beginning.
They, yeah, it's really just the beginning. Because actually, this next stage that you start to think, oh, I'm having these feelings, right? And it's usually around, right, sex and things like that. All these active, you start to think, if I'm thinking about her naked, she could be thinking about me naked. I mean, so you start to have this, oh, if I'm feeling ashamed, they might be feeling ashamed. At this stage, they're not actually, they're just starting to think, oh, I'm feeling guilty, but they're not thinking, oh, that's something that other people feel too.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get to that.
Well, maybe they're aware that their behavior can hurt others. I think that might be the first.
And as a general rule, both in parenting and in leadership or in any kind of relationship, the goal is to pull people one stage. You should always be inviting them to the next stage. You shouldn't be inviting, for example, shouldn't. One might think about not inviting someone from scorekeeper to generative. You might think about them, invite them to be a peacekeeper.
Oh, that's interesting.
I don't know, my scorekeepers are pretty wrapped up in themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, they're exploring sort of the intensity of their own feelings and how they stand with the world. That's what, I don't know how competition fits into a scorekeeper, but where am I in the...
You may want to ask him what he thinks.
There. Should we invite him?
Are you a scorekeeper or a peacekeeper?
You might be in survival mode. Although, they did pretty well there.
I mean, time out is a big
food in here. Okay.
Time out is a big thing that goes on in this age because
okay,
they aren't in control of their feelings.
Because they're not.
They're not in control of their
right.
feelings.
Yeah.
So they have to be put in time out so that they can,
right.
Just recover, as I recall, in a few years. Or is that more 0 to 3?
No, what I was wondering is when we see them acting as 0 to 3, we put them in time out.
Yeah, that's true.
So that they can kind of grow up. Get
yeah,
back up to go get. I don't know, I'm just wondering if that's.
No, that's interesting.
Take a time out to where you can sort of get back control of your feelings and your anger, your emotions, and you can be able to articulate them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to come back to the feelings because, once again, my mind is not blank. But let's go to needs and then we'll. What do your scorekeeper kids need? Or your scorekeeper colleagues and friends?
Well, they respond to great job.
Right.
Yeah, good job.
Well done.
So they need a lot of affirmation. I think that it's just the emergence of the self, right? One of the other thing, if we look at this developmentally, one of the things that's going on is the if we could say the narcissism, the healthy narcissism of an infant, is there is no differentiation between the mother and the child. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very limited differentiation. And then over time, you get individuation.
Mm-hmm.
So over the stages of development are individuating. So you go from a kind of collapsed self, right, to a budding ego, right, to a little bit more of a self-consciousness, because now, they're thinking about me.
Mm-hmm.
But that creates a whole set of problems for the ego, because it becomes highly self-conscious. And then as they become more adult, they think, no, I'm standing in the world as a separate individual. And I would say, as generative, it's a kind of post-ego.
Right.
That once the ego has been established, one can get beyond that, and it's not all about me and my projects, but it's about the larger project of either the institution or, of the church or whatever it is. It's a large God's project of the world is what matters. So vocation, what is God calling me to do, rather than all about my effort to establish myself in the world. But you have to first establish yourself in the world before you can take on those large, at least that's what the theory suggests.
Mm-hmm.
So the need here is affirmation of worth. And their power, because they're concrete literal, they tend to think of the world as a kind of single moral universe, right? With rules, they're very interested in rules. Everything has to be fair. There's a right and a wrong, because we've introduced them into that world. Again, as I said yesterday, that's really what elementary school is about. No, don't do that. Yes, do this. I mean, it's all about right and wrong. So what they want, they're starting to think that the world is set up in a very organized way, right? And that these rules they become internalized,
mm-hmm.
right? That they're really, in ways that as adults recognize, no, rules are functional. No, these are part of the furniture of reality. So
mm-hmm.
so then the problem is, how do I get around the rules when they get in my way? So you get deception, you get dissembling, cheating, and lying as ways of deploying their power.
Mm-hmm.
Or negotiating, the more positive
right.
way is to negotiate. You can have it for 3 minutes, and then I get it for 3 minutes. You can have this piece of pie if I get the same amount.
It starts at 8, what about 8:30? No, what about,
Right, so
I'm trying to push the limits.
Oh, yeah, all of that. Yeah. Negotiating.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Can I have 3 cookies? I really want 5.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, that's funny. Actually, my 3-year-old, I'll say something, she'll say, well, I'll do it twice. And we end up having this long negotiation. Okay, so their commitment, they're able to commit, I would say, if you think about children here, children 0 to 3 will play alongside but not with another child.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what observers say. And maybe, I'm noting my child has just now started to play with another child. She's 3.5. But children at this stage can really play with another child, but only as long as it's fun for them. They're not going to be committed beyond how it's working out for them. So. Their commitment is...
we had said last night, situational, but...
Situational.
But it's how we'd all like to be, to stop immediately when it's no longer fun,
mm-hmm.
that we can't do that.
And we talked about, as adults, certain situations or certain institutional structures elicit different kinds of behaviors. So if you're in a job where there is really no security, then it pays to play as a scorekeeper, because it wouldn't pay to play as a generative person, because you might still want to take that up, but at least you're more invited to be a scorekeeper if you think, it's only those who really make a lot of noise who get the bonus,
mm-hmm.
or it's only those who make a fuss who get what they want. If I just lay back, stay quiet and do my job, I'll get passed over. And some institutions are like that, so it elicits that promise. So the promise here would be, I suppose, that you are accepted as sermon, you are accepted. In some way affirming the work of the person.
The beloved. You are the beloved.
Yeah. Okay, so.
Okay. So then if we move to peacekeeper, this is this age that I think, again, if I do this in groups, people really remember the emotional feelings of this stage. Because it is because I think you become highly self-aware. What you become aware of is that other people have opinions about you. Other people think about you. Mm-hmm. So there is this other eye watching you, right? But it's not, you don't have self-awareness. So it's not a you watching you, right? Which is what adults have. We're able to be self-critical. No, this is the criticism of society. So what matters is not my own judgment of myself.
Peer group.
It's what the peers, my peers, how they are judging me.
What all those things.
So it's not yet, I haven't developed a strong enough self to stand up here and say, you know, no, that's, even if no one was watching, that's not the right thing to do. Here it's, oh, those people are watching, what should I do? So, you know, fashion, the right clothes becomes very important.
What groups you belong to.
Acceptance.
Right. Well, let's think about thinking here.
Yeah, not too much.
Well, they're able to make...
Hormonal thinking, though.
I think it
grows a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're able to think about metaphor, they're able to think about analogies.
That's true.
So it's more complex, it's not concrete literal. The example I gave last night for concrete literal is you can give a nickel, you can trade a nickel for a dime because a nickel with a young child, because they see the nickel is bigger, well, it must be more valuable. But here you can start to, they understand value as a separate thing than its symbolization. So there's a complex relationship in their thinking. Here there's no difference. The value is in the thing. But no, here you can see, no, value is just merely symbolized. So you can start to have this. So God here is like God the Father, the man in heaven with the beard, or the mother in heaven, you know, with the open arms, whatever the metaphor, whatever the way it's described, that's not a metaphor for them. That is the way they really think about it. You know, so heaven is somewhere, right? But here they can start to let go of that and think, no, that's symbolic language. It's trying to describe something that's not true. But yeah.
I was going to say, it seems like during this period that the thoughts and concepts become their own rather than, because I think that's...
Rather than your parents, or...?
That's right, yeah. Now, and I say that hesitantly because I've never had any children, so all the adults say, well, no, it's actually their peers thinking, but it's still their way of differentiating it, their own ownership of it versus their parents thinking of it. And it doesn't end at 15.
Right.
You know, my memory's not as good as to remember all the way back when I was that age, but that seems to me that that's what was happening to me, was that I was slowly, and that ends up why I identified with peers, because it was a way of separating my thoughts and my beliefs so that they were mine rather than my parents.
So definitely, I'm not sure how to capture that, but...
I was going to say ownership of thought.
Yeah.
It seems during this time that, in as far as academically, they're introducing pretty complex things, mathematically, to children, and they're getting excited about these things that aren't tethered to what's, you know, what we would call real or stuff. They really are growing a lot as far as their ability to conceptualize or be involved in abstract thinking.
Actually, there's a huge amount of learning that happens to me intellectually. Because I've got a 13-year-old and a 10-year-old, and just the amount of material that the kids can learn and really understand. You just, it's way beyond their emotional kind of relational stuff. There's a, there's just a surge that happens in fifth grade. And so the way I think about it is that they are becoming aware of the world around them. They're having an interest in how, you know, math very, very categorical in the way that that level of math is taught. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how does the world fit? You know, and I can master that. Not in the sense of, you know, setting out your blocks, but, you know, I'm learning it, I'm mastering it, I'm pulling those things together. And I do agree that it's people's, it's their own thought. I mean, it's very heavily influenced by peers, but clearly a sense of self-awareness that is, you know, it's vulnerable self-awareness, but there are a lot of intellectual abilities at that age. And, you know, in my experience, the people who, I mean, they're gods and goddesses, the people who teach middle school, really, you know, who love that. And, you know, they're happy to see, you know, they pull out the parts that are positive of it. The rest, they're like, you know, that'll sort itself out. And it's amazing what the abilities are of kids in that time, early in that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, what the theorists want to say is that it's abstract and logical. So then that achievement to go from concrete literal to abstract and logical opens up a whole,
yeah.
I mean, I think that what you're describing, a whole new possibility for these kids. But what they also want to notice is that it tends to be uncritical. Right, so this is the kind of third person, the eye behind the eye. Right, so they're becoming self-aware, but aren't yet don't have enough to sort of criticize themselves. I'm a sociologist, so I'm particularly interested in the way social life sort of organizes identity over time. And this is in some ways just again, it's an expansion. So the social world was fundamentally the family, and here it's the peer group. And the self was just budding here, and here you're saying self-awareness is starting to emerge, and they become, I remember it, it's highly self-conscious. So there's definitely a self, a strong self, but they're not yet able to criticize as well. They just, I think the criticism comes from others.
I don't think that's true.
Really?
In my experience, it's not true. And I think it's a good way to categorize, you know, a cross section maybe. But I see a lot of critical thought. And it's not at the level that we would think of as adult critical thought, but it is certainly, you know, critical. Like, my daughter's going through the line today, and she's an unusual person. They think their daughter's unusual. We're going to the line for breakfast, and Paul Enderle was talking about, you know, the Greek gods. She loves the Greek gods. That's that 10-year-old, you know, the categorization, and then the abilities, and the supernatural, and then figuring out are these guys really gods? Do you believe in them and stuff? Just this fabulous thing, you know. And we're going through, and he says, you know, the Greek gods, they were justice. They needed to learn mercy. And I'm like, so Claire Jenkins goes, yeah, I know. You know, she just, there was this sense of, you know, having kind of gone through that and then starting to say, but this is missing. And a lot of that goes on. And you don't see it in a group. Everything gets evened out in the group because everybody is so self-conscious.
Right.
I mean, you see the total dumbing down and interactive. So sociologically, there are all kinds of things going on. Of course, whatever you call social group-wise. But anyway, so I think that's...
Yeah,
but that's not true to my experience with individuals. That's not just my daughter. It's with individuals as a group. I can see that, but I don't see this.
Yeah, I don't want to. I'll take that out because I don't want to. I think that's the wrong place. It's not in their way of thinking that they're unprovable, really. It's a little more in their feelings. Because you're right. I mean, kids can do that. They can make connections because they're able to make abstract logical thinking. They can say, oh. Well, it's not the God. It's the God represents something, justice, and then they can make the next move. So there is a budding critical ability, clearly, and our curriculum just demonstrates that the way that what they're teaching these kids at this age. So I think that's right. But I wonder maybe at the level of feelings that they have some self awareness about their feelings too. But it's still much more being informed by the group. Okay, so the feelings of a peacekeeper. Anyone? a sense of what those might be?
Well, they're
the commitment.
I have that under another category.
No.
Right.
It seems like they want to be a sense of belonging. They want to feel with part of the community.
Oh, so they're committed to their group. The language I use is responsible for it instead of responsible to another person. There's a great sense of responsibility for the whole group.
Right. I get that.
And I might have said this yesterday, but you know, this is the age at which you're on. I was going to say on the phone, but it might be on Facebook. Or you're communicating constantly to make sure everything is okay.
Right. You bet.
You know, you're all on the phone nonstop. That's what I remember. Let's see. So there's a high degree of self-consciousness, right? And this is what people remember, the sort of painful level of self-consciousness of teenagers. Easily embarrassed. That was the one I felt responsible for. And this is sometimes a hard sell when I talk to people, because as a parent, I think they experience their kid as highly autonomous. But in fact, others would say, no, they're very group dependent, very much want to fit in. That's why we call it peacekeepers. They really want to keep the peace and make everybody happy. And actually, parents, I think, are surprised. If you asked kids, maybe not to 15, but to 14 and certainly to 13, who are the most important people in your life? They still say their parents on surveys. And a lot of parents are surprised by that because they feel like the kids are saying, I don't want to talk to you. And, you know, they come in, well, how was your day? And they just walk upstairs. But in fact, they're still saying that their parents are their most important thing.
Because their social group is kind of shifting sand.
Right.
They could be best friends this week and enemies the next day and maybe come back. And it is really shifting sand. So there's no stability in that social group.
I was with someone who has a teenage kid, and he's moving to Chicago, and she's a single mom. I just happened to be at the house, and he comes in, and he's like this tall, right? Big, and he just broke up with his girlfriend, just collapses into his mom's arms, you know, makes me sad even to think about it. Yeah. That could be my 8-year-old girl, you know.
Oh, believe me, it'll be. It's going to happen a thousand times.
So what does a peacekeeper need? And here we can think, if we think about what are the rituals at this age? And if you're Jewish, it's bar mitzvah. If you're Presbyterian like I am, it's often membership into the church.
Confirmation.
15-year-old. How do you say it? Because I'm reading that story. Quinceanera. My 3-year-old, I'm reading a Dora story about daisies, quinceanera. So that's a 15. So there is this kind of transition into, I want to say, belonging. So that's
belonging,
the fundamental
absolutely.
Here is to belong. Mm-hmm. And we recognize that in our ritual life.
Sure.
I actually had a PowerPoint, so that's why I keep going back and forth to this. That's quite last night. How do they get things done? How do they deploy their power?
Oh gosh.
They try to achieve consensus, but do they?
Yeah. They can try to obligate you. Try to achieve consensus. But often they'll try to obligate you and make you feel like you need to do this for them. And it's a pretty kind of common group strategy. And we can also think about...
Is that manipulate? Is that...
Yeah, manipulation a little bit. Obligating.
They figured out the system enough, so they know where your buttons are, and they just go push them like crazy. Is that what you're thinking about?
I'm your best friend.
Yeah.
No. Loyalty is high here.
this is the age at which, you know, kids join gangs.
Or sports or whatever.
Or sport, yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully sports.
Yeah, they also...
clubs.
Sorry? Drugs?
Clubs.
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 Yeah.
Clubs.
Joiners.
Air Patrol.
Teams.
Teams,
yeah.
Cash from my son.
Yeah.
He became very patriotic.
Mm, interesting.
Huh. Interesting. So that's interesting. I wonder, I don't know if the studies show, but there's a kind of budding sense of one's national affiliation.
Right.
You know, some affiliation of all sorts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Become important here.
I mean, they're doing some experimenting and joining, and then they decide which ones are going to continue and which ones are going to continue.
At that age, for my children, there was always the argument, well, Todd's mom is letting him do this, so why can't I do it?
Mm-hmm.
It was all
parental
peer pressure. Yeah.
Well,
and
I hear that.
Todd's mom thinks it's all right. So.
And, you know, one of the things that... sort of moral theorists observe is that people who are adults who are operating out of a peacekeeper mode often do things that are egregious because authority told them to. So,
Abu Ghraib, right?
Yeah.
Or you know, if you listen to the defenses of the Nuremberg trial, it's like, I'm just doing my job.
Mm-hmm.
I was just doing my job. And, you know, the military,
yeah,
really, we even call them peacekeepers,
right?
It's an organization that really values authority, and again, I don't want to overstate it, but they recruit from, you know, the low end of the next stage. Kids are from the low end of the next stage. Now there are career people that are much more mature, but we get kids in the military at a fairly young age. Not this age, but it's not.
Yeah, but there's ROTC on campus, so you
yeah.
do. There's, you know, there are some groups that are getting started.
Okay, so their level of commitment, that I call it. You can see, I'm just trying to show that their commitment over time is becoming more complex.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still here, they're committed to the group,
mm-hmm.
right? And this creates insider-outsider behavior, cliques, or in its extreme form, it can create violence, either gang or tribal or national kinds of violence, because there's this sense that I have a deep obligation to my group.
Mm-hmm.
You're not in my group. I owe you nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a threat to my group, that's a great word. So they're committed to the group. You know, and here we can, skip ahead. You can think a generative leader, a generative person. Let's take Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He's committed, right? He's committed to more than the Jews.
Yeah.
Right. He's committed to more than his disciples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's actually committed to people he doesn't even know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this sort of sense of a universalizing commitment, and I think all the great religious leaders have this sort of sense of a universalizing commitment. And it's not just an abstract relationship, right, of ideas, which I might be able to come up with. But yeah, in a general sense, I believe that everybody should be treated fairly. But it's almost like they actually can imagine and have a relationship with everybody.
Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
I'm seeing as we're going through this today that being at different stages and different things at the same time. So. I may not be 100% in the enforcer mode. I might be thinking in one place and feeling in another and needs in another.
Mm-hmm.
But, so, I mean, that was, you may not be at the same stage of development in all these aspects at the same time if you're in a reversion process. So there
sure.
might be some piece of your development that for whatever reason hasn't moved along at the pace other stages have. We're talking about how this peacekeeper... they're developing intellectually faster than they are emotionally, and I think that can happen.
Well, I think,
with
yeah.
people, they can, you know, their intellect can continue to develop, but their emotion may not get triggered and encouraged and developed for whatever family situation.
Well, this is one of actually the standard, an early critique or
adjustment to developmental theory. Kohlberg came in and said, you know, he looked at particularly moral thinking, right? And you get more abstract moral thinking, and over time, your moral commitments extend. The Kantian imperative is that you would not do that, but it's the golden rule is that not do to anybody what you wouldn't want them to do. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of universalizing principle. But then a woman comes along, a woman theorist who was one of the students, actually, a man, Carol Gilligan, and says, but women experience things differently. They're much more sophisticated at the emotional level. So they may not have this moral reasoning like you want to propose, but they have sort of moral affective sophistication that men often don't have. I mean, you know, men are often, you know, the stereotypical man is emotionally unavailable. Right, so part of it is I don't think that's biological or part of the nature of things, but it's part of the way we organize our social life. So the degree that women are sort of responsible for nurturing mm-hmm. and for the emotional development of children, and not just children but all of our social institutions, they become very good at it. Mm-hmm. So as we get a more equal distribution of the emotional labor in the world, mm-hmm. I think men can become better.
Could I just raise another issue? As we learn about neurological development, where are you hardwired in these stages? Or is your neurological development a key to one of these areas, as you say, going from one aspect to another? Mm-hmm. So I think neurology has become more specific, mm-hmm. and when I first worked for juvenile justice, it was as if, you know, if a 12-year-old is 12, then they have the capacity. They have the capacity to do. And now we know that that's not true. Their brains are still developing. And so we always had to make a decision about whether a child was capable or not in terms of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I do think that, well, at least this theory is dependent on a certain, it's a structural theory, but it's based on the notion that that's biological. They're borrowing actually from biology, right? The sort of developmental stages that we see in other species. So I don't know enough about the neuroscience other than to say I do know that there is a 12-year-old brain. There is a 20-year-old brain.
Right. Right.
There actually is not a man and woman brain. You couldn't put two brains in a lab and have them tell you, is that a woman's brain or is that a man's brain? But you could put two brains in a lab and they can tell you, is that an 18-year-old brain or a 6-year-old brain?
Yes.
Apparently. This is, I know I don't want to
yeah.
go to the grave on that one, but that's what I've been told.
I bet if they looked closer.
Yeah.
I kind of
agree with you, and I think that while the brain matter itself may not be differentiated, there, and that's what you're doing is you're looking at the brain when it's dead,
right?
And that an artificial look at it. What you have to do is you have to look at the brain when it's alive and what are the nutrients that are going to it.
Sure.
And in the case of us poor men, we have testosterone affecting what we see. And whether that shows up in the physiology of the brain is, you know, that I don't know about. But there is other research that shows that there are difference in the way a male brain and a female brain operate.
Right.
Okay. But in terms of what they see, in terms of connections, difference, so there's other research that shows that there are indeed differences.
Sure, and this is outside of my expertise.
Yeah,
I'll say one last thing about it.
Yeah.
to what I know, and I'm a sociologist, so,
yeah.
And that is that, well, these differences, the brain develops, each brain develops uniquely, so how do we know that those differences aren't a consequence of experience? How do we know that they're hardwired differences, right? That they are, you know, that we could say, yeah, there's a difference.
It's the old nature, nurture, or
right.
Those,
right.
Yeah.
Even to the brain, that the brain itself can be nurtured to a particular shape.
Yeah, and that, I think you're right in that sense, and I think that, but there are also gender differences that you can identify right away, which is, like I point out, the difference in the hormones that are going through the bloodstream or make for a different difference. But what I find interesting, I don't mean to have you go off, send you off too far, but as a sociologist, have you ever read The True Believer by Eric Conner?
No, I saw you reading it. It's a classic, right?
It's a classic. What's fascinating, because I just read, before coming over here, his assessment and your characteristics of peacemaker is what Eric Hoffer says that mass movements call for.
Mm-hmm.
And he was even talking about how the ritual of the army, where you all put them in uniforms and you put little badges on them, and then he didn't say it, but I was also reflecting on what I've heard of people that go into basic training. And one of the things they do is they will take and force you in military to get to this peacemaker mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about it, you talked about you wanted to leave uncritical thinking at the top. And we were kind of discussing about that. And as I think about it, that's one of the things that should be there.
Mm-hmm.
Because at this level, they aren't. I mean, there are. I mean, I know you cited some examples of some critical thinking, but at this level, at the peacekeeping level, they aren't able to step beyond and recognize, and in fact, not only they're not able to, but they don't want to step to the next step and realize where their deception, where they're being deceived.
Right.
Okay. And what's even more is a society relies on that so that we can send young men to die, telling them that they're dying for God and the Queen, telling them that we're dying for freedom in America, telling them, you know, and until we convince them of this deception, we can't convince them to die. And so our societies actually rely on bringing critical, what otherwise would be critical thinkers to this level so that we can convince them to die for something that they would not otherwise have died for.
Well, I'm not unpersuaded by that argument. Although, I do think that since they want to belong, I mean, I don't know if you go to what's your default, think about it. Which one of these seems most familiar to you? And I haven't hit the fourth one, which we have about 5 minutes. I'll try to go to. I default to peacekeeping, which is who do I need to make happy?
Mm-hmm.
Who do I need to make happy? And so, you know, all that means is if you have a critical capacity, but it's overridden by the desire to make the authorities happy.
Yeah.
So I find myself, and I have to catch myself, well, why do I care so much what my boss thinks, right? Or what my wife thinks, even, or, you know, damn, my kids. I mean, I'm trying to make them happy. I'm trying to make everybody happy. It's going to be exhausting, right?
Yeah.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where I can get triggered to pretty easily, the peacekeeping. And it's part of my own script, which I haven't really talked about. We get triggered to these because of our unique scripts. I'm the youngest of five, only son, right, who basically was asked to make my mother happy in the ways that my father never did. So it's this basic psychological story, right? Common Freudian trope. You know, that I was supposed to win the Oedipus struggle. So that creates a kind of, you know, always, you know, figuring out how people are feeling. That's a gift in some ways. But it can also be a burden, and it can limit me from acting out of a more generative mode. And so I would ask, you know, and I think all adults have this tendency to land in one or another place, but I can also, hey, I can be a sport kid. You know, I can think, okay, they're making more money than I am, what's going on, I'm doing all the work. I can get triggered there too under certain circumstances. And, you know, when I'm driving, when do we become enforcer?
He's at the driving
word. Down the street, that's when we're most likely to use profanity, get angry, because actually our survival for a second is at stake. You know, that guy's coming over here. You don't say, well, can you please move over? You know, you say something else. Oh, yeah. I do. You can get triggered, but I do have this sort of default mode. So let me quickly, we could say, what would the...
Well, let's erase the enforcer and do the fourth
one,
if you don't mind.
But I just want to say, what's
the sixth thing?
I'm on, well, it depends on the model. I'm using 5 models. I'm using 5 stages.
Okay.
So here are 6 is, what would the gospel look like to a peacekeeper?
Family, God, community, and Christ.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Koinonia, right.
Mm-hmm. Community and Christ. That is family. Being a part of the family of God or the community of Christ. But we used child of God before, so I think it's a community. You know, when it gets confirmation, you've joined the community of Christ. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's the same deal.
Yeah, and you're not just a child. You're starting to become an actual
an adult
member.
You say you're an adult member of the church.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you give them, you know, you do the collection or... do something on Youth Sunday. Do you actually make them part of the community?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Well, quickly, I'll do. If you want to leave, I won't be offended. I'm going to quickly cover this last page, which is we call Rebel Producer. Now, just to go on the peacekeeping, most institutions are peacekeeping institutions because it's in the interest of the institution to have peacekeepers. But the problem is, peacekeepers are not good innovators, because they don't challenge, right? They don't say, whoa, I'm not marching up that hill.
Right.
So rebel producers have critical thinking. Now this is, you know, 18 to 22 or whatever, or, you know, for many people it's 18 through the rest of their lives. they have critical reasoning capacities, but it tends to be either or. They can feel superior and dismissive of other people. Because the job of the stage is to differentiate. The job is to finally be an adult member of society, that's not a member of your clan, not a member of your family, but an independent person. So you start to, the downside is that you can be dismissive. You say, if I want to do something, if I want something done right, I got to do it myself. If you ever find yourself saying that, then you might think, oh, am I being a rebel producer? Right. And we call it rebel producing because you're rebelling against the groups that you once so desperately wanted to be a part of, family and peers. So, you know, this is when you start to differentiate yourself from your, you go to college and you're starting to think outside the box and dismissal and we'll see.
So in societies that don't take people on to college, does this stage missing, or?
Well, interesting. It's interesting that
they don't have an outside the family or outside their peer group experience. Do they miss the stage? Or?
Yeah.
They become a laborer.
I mean, it may be that you may very well go from this stage to generative, because you become a. Often you go right from your household to starting your own household, and that is one of the states that the transitions to generative is you actually start to generate your own household, own community. Yes.
Well, isn't one of the, because you were saying about feeling of superior, I'm not sure you have to go to college to get to the point where you're convinced you're smarter than your parents.
No. And actually, some kids are too smart. Too cool for school.
Yeah, they're too cool for school. Right. They're too smart for school. So that is, they actually end up being dismissal of higher education.
Right. Institutions. Right. So it's dismissal.
Jen's right. Still, if it's a society that has a higher educational level, it's a good question is whether this stage is missed.
So what you need to feel, I think, I'll go quickly if you don't mind. You need to feel like you're confident, that you have something to offer the world. So this is what kids want to know. They want to. This is when you develop your own sense of okay, this is what I'm going to be, kind of doctor, I'm going to become a basketball, whatever it is, you know, you have a sense of what you're going to be in the world.
It's a career.
So you become career-minded.
Not really. Perhaps vocation, but more career.
Yeah, I use the word vocation kind of fairly carefully in the sense of what is God calling you to be.
Right.
Are they transitional at that age as well? They're making a transition. I'm thinking about some employees that we had for a while, and it was difficult for them to separate from the academic life. Mm-hmm. They still wanted to be thought of as brilliant or having all the answers or being critical thinkers. And yet it was difficult for them to actually produce something.
Right. Well, academics, I mean, I'm an academic, are notoriously lousy team players. They would never make it in corporate America. Or maybe it's that the institution that we live in is set up in such a way that we're asked to behave in this value-producing way.
Well, having worked in corporate America, most workers in corporate America don't make it in corporate America. Yeah, they make their living there, but they don't like it.
Right. All right. Fair enough.
What's their power?
So their power. How does a rebel producer get what they want from the world? They're very good at sort of coming and saying, shape up, get the job done, motivational speeches, but they're less good at sort of mentoring people. They're good at bossing people, but not so good at mentoring people.
I just know people who are always against something. Huh. You know, it's always, a lot of this projection is somebody else's fault, but it's also, their mode is just a fighting kind of rebellious mode. Like they never get free to get to a place of peace or a place of centeredness.
So what is there a kind of verb you would put to that?
Yeah, rebellion, I guess.
Oppositional.
Oppositional. Chip on your shoulder.
Yeah.
Well, it's common in social justice circles where, you know, the idea is to be against,
right,
rather than to say, well, really, here's how we can do this.
Right.
And there is growth to be made from that position.
Yeah, I mean, these people get things done in the world. This is where innovation comes from. They get things done. The problem tends
to
be...
We prize innovation in some ways. In other ways, we don't. Yet, they get things done. And I work for the city of Seattle, and I see as people, these are planners. And they come in and they know just how the whole everything should be going. People go into urban planning and they think, well, we're going to tell people where to park and how to do it. Great. They come in, they make a huge mess. They make their point. They move on to another position.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the people are going, and, you know, this doesn't sit because it didn't come from, you know, within. So getting things done, I think it's interesting. You know, what does that mean?
Well, yeah,
they move things.
I mean,
they churn things up.
Yeah, and you get to a point that is really crucial, that they're, these institutions, they're like this, they go up and down, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our rebel producers, institutions that are organized by rebel producers, up and down. I mean, a lot of people say, the tech boom of the 90s, all young guys, all rebel producers, they took off, but what they can't do is build an organization, right? They're creative, they're innovative, but they're not the kind of people that keep things going. I find that rather convincing, and I think that describes the consultant that you're talking about.
It's how would you say anti-authority?
Uh-huh.
You know, always questioning.
Anti-establishment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anti-establishment.
Which again, it serves a good function, but not over time, right? So actually, that's why I think you have consultants. They come in, they stir the pot, they leave, and other people are expected to sort of
pick up the pieces
and nurture the organization.
Because they're the brilliant ones, you know. And so, it's a real different model from saying we'll go from within an institution and build on those pieces. You know, take the time to figure out what has sustaining power. That's not really this person that you're talking about.
Right. So I might say the difference between being smart but not wise. We talked about it. brilliant. Yeah, they are. They're brilliant, but they're not always wise. I hope you kind of get the feel of that 18 to 22 year old sense of the world. You know, there's a certain impatience that they have. So their commitment, they're pretty committed, you know, to the project as long as they've got a stake in it.
Yeah, it's a pretty big ego operating
there.
Yeah,
big ego.
So they're pretty committed to themselves and their role and the mark they're going to make. And
what's the hard ones? What would be, so their level of commitment is ego-driven.
Stakeholders?
Driven stakeholders, yeah.
Two, yeah.
Okay, what might gospel look like? I hadn't thought about this before I walked in the room.
They're the prophets.
Well, maybe they're doing. They can imagine doing a new thing. Maybe they can imagine the new thing.
Yeah, Isaiah says, you know,
they're not stuck in the old. They're not stuck in the old. And
prophets.
Well, you know, I teach at a divinity school, and you know, the big sort of common every student is ready to change the church. Mm-hmm. Wants to change the world. You know.
Please do.
And you know, the old joke is there's these two long-time women members of a Presbyterian church, and they sit down and they say, "Oh, I see we have a guest preacher from the seminary coming. Get ready to feel bad about yourself." the church also needs people.
Yeah, renewers of the church. That'd be what Martin Luther.
Mm-hmm. That's Time Magazine had a leadership piece. I think it was last week, and Desmond Tutu was the. Mm-hmm.
It's a sweet spot, and kind of give whatever they don't destroy is going to be made better.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know,
they discern baby in bathwater.
I
find
this extremely trying.
Do you?
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, thanks for sticking a little along. Tomorrow I want to talk a little bit about how our own particular scripts connect back to this, and the idea that actually where our needs are is where our pain is, and that creates in us, as a by way of preview, our self-protection, which is our defensiveness, but it also, right, is where our giftedness is, our giftedness and our self-protection in an ironic way come from the same place.
How did morality get worked into the title of what you're doing?
How is this about moral development?
Right.
Well,
I thought, well, I'm not going to go to that. You know, morality?
Well, the book I'm working on is on the ethics of commitment. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think about commitment in terms of, and I didn't follow that out as much today as I might have, but in terms of human development. So, what are we capable of being committed to? And how do stages relate to commitment? So, I'm really interested in that question of commitment, which really means to be with, right? To go together with someone. That's what commitment is. And there's a sense of over time, you know, real commitment is over time. And so, I'm thinking about that. So, sorry, it's not obvious that it's.
We've heard this so much from the Bush administration, you know, that they have a moral kind of authority to go and change all of these countries to make them democratic. And so that's, you know, my objection to that kind of morality, the use of that term.
Oh, well, I'm glad you came in.
Yeah, I am too. Only because the Bible study person mentioned that
you got a plug.
You got a plug.
Just tell me what your categories are for generative.
Yeah.
I mean, I obviously missed something. Sorry.
Right.
We won't need to fill out our columns. We have to
fill out your
columns. Number one.
So thinking is dialectic. It can be both and rather than either or, right? You're able to actually bring together seemingly contradictory notions, right? And it's creative and innovative. So it has all the It has all the things of these other stages and more, right? Which each stage actually has, or the other stage has, and more. So that's what, in terms of thinking, dialectical, both and creative and innovative. In terms of the needs, the need of a is meaning and purpose. So we can think more in terms of vocation. Who am I to be in the world, rather than what am I to do in the world? And then, not that the question of doing, it matters, it continues to matter, but it comes under this larger question of who am I to be in the world, and who has God called me to be? Feelings are empathetic, curious, instead of critical. So the generative person gets curious rather than critical. Huh, I wonder why they did that. No, rather than, what an idiot, they did that again. So curious rather than critical. For feelings, congruent. So here, the feelings that you get from a person are seem real. Sometimes, a peacekeeper. So, you're so eager to please that you meet other people's feelings, but it may not actually be how I'm actually feeling. But I'm so trying to get with you that all of a sudden, we're beating on the same. So it's, but no, these are congruent feelings. What's real for the person are being communicated. Power is self-acceptance. So actually, power comes from accepting oneself in one's limitedness and one's giftedness. So you have an honest appraisal. Yeah, I'm not perfect, but I'm more than enough for the job. Mm-hmm. Or I'm not enough for this job yet. I need to get these, but I just need to get these things. It's not like I'm not enough for the job. Oh, I'm terrible. I'm useless. I'm not enough for the job. I need to get these four things, then I'll be enough, or I'm never going to be enough, so I need to bring in somebody else. But it's a realistic appraisal, and self-acceptance. That's actually a form of power. They're motivated by the universal good rather than the community or the belonging or the ego good. And their commitment is, they're committed to doing what needs to be done, when it needs to be done, with whomever it needs to be done.
Relationships in that category as well.
Yeah. I mean, this is the hardest one for me, is sort of generative commitment, to think, am I really committed to doing what needs to be done and saying what needs to be said, which is, when you did that, it really made me angry or upset. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Good evening.
Oh, yeah. They were supposed to pick you up at 12 o'clock. Sorry.
Luckily she knew where to go. Yeah, we were keeping the teacher after class right today.
So that's the last one, and then I suppose I don't know what the gospel would be. But the need is
all things are possible.
Yeah, that's nice. All things are possible. Then go.
Yes. Or it's calling, it's vocation.
Yeah.
You know, I've got to come up with a verse for you a little bit.
Well, thank you. And again, tomorrow, if you want to come back, we'll talk about our own unique scripts and how they relate to these. Well, not tomorrow, Friday.
Friday.